Hello to all of you and welcome to Viewpoints on this week's show. From riot to parade, protesters say Toronto Pride has lost its way.
The corporate pride that dominates the streets of Toronto every year has, I think, completely lost the focus of what Pride began as, which was a riot against policing.
New Brunswick Premier Holt and Tourism Minister Thériault take the scenic route on a fact-finding mission to Murray Beach and Baie Verte.
We're listening closely to the people of the region tell us what is their priority and that influences what we do next.
We can see the province from our own eyes.
The platform Pilsner comes to life as BC's public transit experiments new funding models.
We're always trying to think of new ways, creative ways to generate a little bit of revenue. I think the first of its kind program, not just in Canada, but possibly in North America, when you think about a transit agency doing something like this.
We'll meet up with a group of bat watchers in Montreal.
We've mainly seen big brown bats, silver-haired bats, and hoary bats. Sometimes a tri-colored bat will appear.
And do you wonder what goes on in a fire station? We're touring one in Winnipeg with Ryan Funk.
Our interest with this facility is also to be a part of the community, to be an inviting space.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is Boris Chassin. I'll be with you for the next half hour as we travel to Burnaby, BC, Montreal, Quebec, Sackville, New Brunswick, Toronto, Ontario, and Winnipeg, Manitoba this week. Our first stop will be out east in the Maritimes to meet up with New Brunswick Premier Susan Holt and Tourism Minister Isabelle Thériault. They were both on a fact-finding mission last week, getting some input from locals, business owners, and tourists as well. On Wednesday, June 25th, Holt and Thériault visited a number of spots in the southeast of the province, including Murray Beach Provincial Park, where Holt got an earful from people talking about transportation and infrastructure issues in that rural area. Journalist Erica Butler caught up with the political pair at Bistro Le Chableur, Blue Cat, in Baie Verte, Green Bay, and started by asking them about their itinerary.
Well, we started the day at Tony's Bistro in Dieppe.
Then Moncton. This is the one in Moncton East on the road.
Oh, really? Well, yeah, original. There are two locations.
The original. They have now four. Yeah. Tony's has grown to four locations, but we are at the original location of the best croissants in Moncton.
And then we went biking along the Chocolate River to see the tidal bore. Then after, we went to Murray Beach.
That we went to Murray Beach Provincial Park, and it was great to talk to the staff there about all of the increase in activity, increase in amenities, the rustic cabins that they have, the more service sites, and it was beautifully kind of quiet and a great place to hang out. Now we're here at the Bistro Le Chableur, which has been a delicious place to have lunch. Feels like an undiscovered gem, although it's been really busy, so clearly discovered by lots of folks. Next is
Les Petits Fruits de Pré d'en Haut in Memram Cook. Then we're going to do a meet and greet at the Crooked Distillery, so people can come and meet Premier Holt, and then we're going and the team, and we're going to finish the evening at Les Jeux de l'Acadie, a celebration of all the sport teams from all the francophone regions.
What have you been hearing from people? I'm guessing, you know, I mean, I know if you've been up in Murray Corner Provincial Park, one of the things you might have heard about a little is, you know, infrastructure like highway conditions and that sort of thing and the role that plays in tourism. Have you been hearing that from people?
Yeah, we did hear that from some of the folks there and actually here at the restaurant today that we've been chatting with, that that they love those assets and they want to see them showcased. And when you've got a very bumpy road that's been patched a lot of times, taking you to one of our provincial tourism assets, it maybe sends a message that we could improve.
Yeah. Is there, I know that, you know, this is not like under the jurisdiction of the Minister of Tourism, although you do play a role in in the prioritizing of some of these roads that get used. So how does that, I mean, how does that come across your desk? Have you heard a lot about transportation in these kind of rural areas that you're in?
Yes, yes, we hear about it. It's a prerogative of the Department of Transport and Infrastructure, but of course I hear it as a Minister of Tourism, because as Premier said, we want to make sure that the access to the provincial parks are well entretenu, yeah. well maintained. Sorry about that.
We talk about it as a team, right? Both how you plan the scheduling of investments in infrastructure and the work. When does the work get done? Because it's the busy season for construction and tourism at the same time. And we talk about how we can schedule those things best, how we're supporting rural areas, tourism assets, and communities with their priorities, and making sure that we're listening closely to the people of the region tell us what is their priority, and that that influences what we do next.
And this is the reason why it's important to go out and see, like, for us to be on the ground and listen to people and see those infrastructures. So that's
drive the roads.
Yeah. So we do this touristic week, but at the same time, we can see the province from our own eyes.
I would be remiss, being from Sackville, if I didn't ask about covered bridges, because as you, I'm sure you both know, we have a beloved covered bridge that's been closed for a while, and they're so iconic, they're associated with New Brunswick. Do you think that a covered bridge kind of program is going to figure into tourism planning in the future? It seems to cross over. I mean, no, this is another infrastructure question for you, but the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure doesn't really prioritize any bridge over another bridge, but you might find a different value in them.
Yes, these are beautiful assets that our province have. We have a lot of covered bridges in New Brunswick. So, but we're hearing people again, and we know that it's important for them to keep them. So I'm constantly having discussions with my colleague, Minister Chuck Chiasson, Minister of DTI, and he realizes also that these are important assets for province.
Yeah. And I would add, you say that DTI treats them all like a bridge. They don't, actually, right? DTI has a process for evaluating the value of an asset, and its touristic value is included in those considerations, as well as whether it's a route that's used for economic purposes, whether it's a route to a hospital or a school, whether it's a route where vulnerable people might be abandoned. Like, there's lots of consideration that goes into each of the assets, and so covered bridges are absolutely considered as not just bridges, but bridges with extra value when DTI is evaluating what kind of maintenance something needs and its import and how much we're prepared to invest in it, because the covered bridges are a tourism asset. I mean, my aunt wrote a book once of drawings of covered bridges. So she has a little book she drew sort of pencil drawings of covered bridges all around the province and sold that book as a tourism promotion and tried to attract people to those. Yes. We're having that conversation with communities like Sackville that care very deeply for these pieces of their identity and history that we need to preserve. And so, absolutely, it's important to New Brunswickers, it's important to tourism, and it's important to us.
That's New Brunswick Premier Susan Holt and Tourism Minister Isabelle Thériault speaking with CHMA on Wednesday afternoon at Bistro Le Chable in Baie Verte.
That was Erica Butler.
Tune to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
To Toronto, where tens of thousands filled the streets on Sunday, June 29, for Toronto's Pride Parade, waving rainbow flags, throwing confetti and blowing bubbles. For Pride Weekend, the city closes off several blocks along Church and Yonge for local artists, street vendors, and for hundreds of floats to pass through. But in 2025, many activists reject this vision of Pride. Toronto's first ever Pride was a political political march following a series of bathhouse raids. In February 1981, the Toronto police raided four bathhouses known as Operation Soap, arresting approximately 286 men. People gathered in Grange Park that year to commit to a better world for queer people in Canada. Now, some 40 years later, people are doing just that again. Toronto police cleared 13 encampments last week at Barbara Hall Park on Church Street to make space for a Pride fundraiser, which activists argued went against Pride's core principles, that is, to stand in solidarity with the most marginalized members of our community. Mia Johnson went out to that counter-protest in Grange Park on Sunday morning to hear from criminal defense lawyer Arash Gyasi and activist and journalist Desmond Cold, who demanded that police participation in Toronto's Pride festivities be abolished for good.
I came out today because I really think that, like, the current state of policing is not what we need to keep our society much safer.
I do think there has been a little bit of ignoring of what Pride started as and the history of Pride as a movement.
We will never give up our right to take up space in these streets to demonstrate for all men.
Amid Pride celebrations this week on Church and Yonge, there were also activists who took to the streets to protest the involvement of police in Pride festivities. Pride Toronto spends just over $400,000 annually on security costs. That includes both private and paid duty police. On the morning before Toronto's Pride parade, criminal defense lawyer Arash Gyasi told reporters that funds should be reallocated.
A perfect example of police funding taking away from our communities happened earlier this week at the 519 Community Center, a center that is meant to serve vulnerable members of our community in Church and Wellesley area, including unhoused queer and trans people who have nowhere to stay other than at the nearby Barbara Hall Park.
Last week, Toronto police arrested four people and at least 13 encampments were removed from the park to make space for the fundraiser, a long-standing feature of Toronto Pride. The 519 declined to participate in an interview with our station, but did say the fundraiser is to raise money for queer people experiencing homelessness.
It's sad to see that Pride has turned from an opportunity to stand in solidarity with the most marginalized members of our community to an opportunity to call the police on them. We reject this vision of Pride.
Activist and journalist Desmond Cole says Pride has strayed from its roots.
The corporate Pride that dominates the streets of Toronto every year has, I think, completely lost the focus of what Pride began as, which was a riot against policing, which was a struggle by queer and trans people to be able to be safe in our own streets. And we're at a time now in 2025 when the organizers of Toronto Pride are telling us that because of policing and security costs, they're, you know, in danger of being able to run their own events. So I think that this is a really important contrast. We don't invite the police to our celebration. We don't cooperate with the police. We use this opportunity every year to talk about the first Pride demonstrations, to talk about bathhouse raids, to talk about Marie Curtis Park and undercover police investigations, to entrap queer people cruising in parks, and to say that, like, those realities are still with us today.
Cole helped lead the march Sunday, where we caught up with him, starting in Grange Park, where over 100 protesters were in attendance, boycotting the city's celebrations.
So it's not time for us to wave a rainbow flag or shoot a water gun with the cops. It's time for us to continue fighting for our liberation.
This is Mia Johnson with the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
The Transportation Agency of Metro Vancouver, called TransLink, recently announced an unusual collaboration with a beer company. Patina Brewing, located in British Columbia, partnered with TransLink to release a public transit-themed craft beer the Platform Pilsner. Why, you might ask? Well, while this is a novel collaboration, it's one that TransLink hopes is able to inspire other unique collaborations with local businesses, generating new sources of revenue. To learn more about this unusual association between TransLink and the Patina Brewing, journalist Danny Nesvadarani reached out to John Zhang, TransLink's media relations advisor.
It's a really, really good question. So first of all, you know, TransLink as an organization, we're always trying to think of new ways, creative ways to generate a little bit of revenue that doesn't involve us having to increase the fares for customers. And with that in mind, our CPMP team, which is our corporate partnerships and program team, they essentially are tasked with coming up with creative ways to find other organizations, businesses, or opportunities to find these revenue streams. As another example, I'll mention that we introduced Amazon lockers on TransLink SkyTrain stations and transit hubs a couple of years back, again, to also realize that customers could use this as a benefit. When you're working and going to school, you want to pick up a package along the way home. It's really convenient to do it right at your SkyTrain station or transit hub. So they kind of came to us and said, hey, we have this idea of a partnership with Patina, and we think it'd be a really great way to do it. And I just immediately thought, well, that seems like an excellent idea. Let's see what we can do. And so we were able to partner with Patina and license the intellectual property for TransLink and kind of work together to create the Platform Pilsner. It's, I think, the first of its kind program, not just in Canada, but possibly in North America, when you think about a transit agency doing something like this. So we were really proud of the fact that it's kind of progressive. And come on, let's be real. Metro Vancouver is known for a lot of different things, including a very strong craft beer scene.
Later on, we asked him if this collaboration opens the door for other TransLink-themed products, whether that be a TransLink sneaker or any other array of TransLink food items or specialty drinks, like the one that's seen in this collaboration with Patina Brewing.
You know what? I guess never say never. I don't know that anything is in the works for a TransLink sneaker, though that would be a pretty cool idea. Obviously, if a sneakerhead is listening right now, I'm sure they'd love that. But for us, again, it's just trying to find creative ways to generate a little bit of that revenue. So the Amazon partnership with the lockers, again, being a really good example of us doing something like that. Obviously, it's not like a TransLink locker. It's still an Amazon branded locker. Amazon is the one that provides those lockers. We just give them the space and the lease to do it. But it gives us a little bit of money where if we hadn't done that partnership, we wouldn't be getting that money. And all of that money still goes to support and fund operational services across Metro Vancouver. So, you know, I think if you've got other brilliant ideas like TransLink sneakers, TransLink snacks, food, nothing is off the table as long as it makes sense for us as an organization, for our customers, and also for the organizations that we'd be partnering with. It's basically the task of having to come up with all these different creative ways to generate a little bit of revenue. And I would say, like, there's never too little. Like, any bit that we can get through programs like the collaboration with Patina Brewing, it just goes to help everyone, whether it's us having to keep the services or the customers who depend on having those services every single day.
Thanks to Danny Nesvadarani.
Or comments, our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
From British Columbia, we now move back to Montreal to catch up with a group of bat watchers. In Montreal's borough of Notre-Dame-de-Grâce, NDG if you prefer, there's a group of researchers and community members who go out at night to listen to the sounds of bats. The event is called Bat Walks, and the first bat walk of the year took place on the evening of June 26. The bat walkers record bat sounds using wildlife acoustic technology. These sensitive microphones are able to isolate sounds too high-pitched for human ears. The Bat Walks are run by the group Finding Urban Nature, or FUN, a partnership between a charity group called Urban Nature Education in NGG and Concordia University's Biology Department. FUN leads public talks, tours, and other events to help get citizens engaged with urban nature. Adam Innes in Montreal.
You've heard of bird watchers, but how about bat watchers? Here in NDG, there is a group of researchers and community members who go out at night and pick up the sounds of bats. They're called bat walks, and the first bat walk of the year took place on the evening of June 26th. This is the sound of a bat recorded near Terry Fox Park along Rue Saint-Jacques. This sound was gathered using wildlife acoustic technology. Sensitive microphones are able to isolate sounds too high-pitched for human ears. The bat walks are run by a group called Finding Urban Nature, or FUN, a partnership between the charity group Urban Nature Education and Concordia's Biology Department. FUN leads public talks, tours, and other events to help get citizens engaged with urban nature.
I think kids generally understand it with just kind of as a basic treasure hunt in their own community to find a new thing that they didn't know about before. And I think everyone is a kid at some level that comes out here to learn what more there is in their community, in their daily life, that they might not have noticed before. And once you've noticed them, it's hard to unnotice them.
That was FUN's director, Karen Fisher-Favre. She was out with the team of students and community members. The people on the bat walks are given wildlife acoustic microphones attached to iPads. These pick up the sounds of the bats, as members of FUN explain the importance of bats in the area.
The main ecosystem service that these bats provide to our community is really reducing the number of insects. So a bat can eat up to 1,000 insects an hour in the middle of summer, and the nursing females get up to 4,000 an hour.
The group is in its third year running the bat walks. Here's Concordia researcher Ashley Spanier-Lebasse talking about some of the bats they've seen on these walks.
We've mainly seen big brown bats, silver-haired bats, and hoary bats. Occasionally, mostly down by the water, we've gotten eastern red bats. Sometimes a tricolored bat will appear, and there's been a few really random ones that we're not very confident in have reappeared.
In addition to bat walks for public education, the Concordia researchers here are also studying what are called flight corridors, examining the paths that bats take through the skies so that cities can plan development without disturbing the winged animals. I'm Adam Innes.
Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoint.
And our last stop will be in Winnipeg this week, where we meet up with Ryan Funk, who was on location when the new fire and paramedic station in Windsor Park officially opened its doors to the public last week. The first thing you notice, he says, when you walk into the station is how open everything is. It was all by design, says Deputy Chief Tom Wallace, who explains that this was to feel more inviting for the community and for the nearby schools and students who could just look out and see first responders and maybe, who knows, get inspired. Ryan Funk.
It's to invite them in to see what we do, but to work towards being part of the community that we serve. One of our attendees at the commissioning ceremony last week highlighted the fact that when our staff are working out in the fitness room upstairs, there's a school right across the street. So the kids who are on the playground can look up and see what the firefighters and paramedics are doing and perhaps see themselves in a career in emergency services.
At its core, the station reflects a shift towards localized integrated training. It houses a multi-purpose classroom space, that doubles as a meeting area, playing a key role in Winnipeg's hazardous material or hazmat response program. This station is also equipped to provide on-site hazmat training. Deputy Chief Wallace says this reduces the need to send crews across town to other facilities, keeping vital emergency resources closer to the community they serve. The location was also a carefully considered decision.
So years ago, when we were in the project initiation phase for this project, we had to start by identifying a location. And there was a lot of interest in that time at locating this facility closer to Lagimogie with the idea that you could quickly get north or south. But in doing some reading on best practices, we found that you really need to locate the facility and the resources where your calls for service are.
After studying the locations from which calls for medical and fire services were coming, 1083 Autumnwood Drive was chosen. Deputy Chief Wallace says that it was right in the middle of the calls, so emergency services could more safely, effectively, and efficiently respond to them.
As members of the Winnipeg Fire Paramedic Service, we are public servants first and foremost, and we want the public to know that that is our primary role, is serving the public. But again, as I say, our interest with this facility is also to be a part of the community, to be an inviting space.
Deputy Chief Wallace adds that with their classroom space, it will also be able to have public education and fire prevention staff deliver programming directly from the new facility.
I mean, if you look at this corner, we've got two schools, we've got churches here, we've got local businesses. These are all, there's a real potential there, I think, for improving service delivery.
Public visibility and support were just part of the design priorities, with efficiency the other. The hose tower also serves as a decontamination room, and an air bottle filling station helps crews refill gear without leaving their area. Fast opening bifold doors speed up response time, while clean gear storage, showers, and laundry reduce health risks. It's also the city's first building with geothermal heating and cooling, and is estimated to cut emissions by 98.6% compared to other buildings its size. These decisions are being used as a benchmark for other projects across Winnipeg.
So we have three projects that are in the planning stages right now for stations elsewhere within the city. We're taking lessons learned from this facility and feedback from our staff and the public about what they would like to see in those projects and trying to incorporate that feedback into those projects at this early phase.
The space also utilized materials from the old station, creating outdoor benches and the kitchen table from the reclaimed wood. Deputy Chief Wallace notes that this ties the past to the future and their continued commitment to serve the community. I'm Ryan Funk.
As we close our show this week, thanks to our journalists Ryan Funk, Danny Nesbadarani, Erica Butler, Mia Johnson, and Adam Innes. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. It was a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for keeping us company this week and to your radio station for giving us a voice. And until the next one, take care. Ciao.